Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, July 11th, 2010, here in WILL AM 580. Our economy is in trouble. Our environment is probably in worse trouble, and they're both intricately related and connected. Today we're going to have as our guest the author of a new book which explains the crisis, its numbing reality, its threatening reality, and provides a solution, Plenitude. Our guest will be Juliet B. Shore, joining us today on the phones. But before we go to her, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The National Congress of American Indians, which represents 580 tribes, passed a resolution in support of net neutrality during its mid-year General Assembly meeting in Rapid City, South Dakota. The resolution also supports the efforts of the Federal Communications Commission to reestablish its authority to regulate the broadband industry. NCAI's Dante Desiderio says that net neutrality is important to keep online content free from censorship.
You know, we are tribal governments. Some of the concerns that tribal governments may come down on an issue that may not be popular with the mainstream media, and we want to make sure that there are other providers that are available so that our content is not filtered.
Desiderio says that discussions about broadband have been ongoing.
These issues are debated often before a resolution is ever drafted. So there's been a lot that's been going on with telecommunications in the past few years. There's been significant advances in telecommunications for tribes. So it's an issue that tribal leaders and some of their representatives have been weighing in on for a while.
The resolution, which had wide support among tribal leaders, carries their voice and guides negotiations and discussions with industry and government officials. Most tribes have been left behind by the technological advances made in the private sector. Some broadband service providers border the reservations, but they won't offer service there.
Traditional providers had the opportunity to partner with tribes in the past, and that hasn't happened. So we really feel strongly that the competition to meet our needs of having multiple service providers is really important, and it's not just important for accessing those services, but it's also important for the variety of services that tribal governments are offered.
Telecommunications means a lot more than connecting to the Internet. Desiderio says there are other considerations, like telemedicine and long-distance learning.
A lot of these reservations cover a vast amount of area and are not as heavily populated, so it's really important to have both telemedicine and long-distance learning services along with the other services, and this is really the infrastructure for creating a good foundation for business development and connecting to other markets.
To read the National Congress of American Indians resolution supporting net neutrality, go to ncai.org.
And now for some Media Minutes updates. While the United States still has 300 million people lacking high-speed internet access, last week Finland became the first country in the world to declare broadband access a legal right for its citizens. Internet service providers in the country are now obligated to connect every home to connections that can run a minimum of 1 megabit per second. Over the next 5 years, the government has vowed to increase the connection speed to 100 megabits per second. 96% of the population is already online in Finland, and officials believe that there are only 4,000 homes that still need to be connected. The nation has also stated that its approach to file sharing will be less harsh than many of its European neighbors. Internet service providers will send letters to illegal file sharers, but they will not adopt policies that would cut off service entirely, like the UK and France have suggested they may implement. The Dish Satellite Network has taken the Federal Communications Commission to court over a legal requirement that it carry HD public broadcasting by next year. DISH claims that this must-carry mandate infringes on its First Amendment rights. The requirement, written as an amendment to the Satellite Television Extension and Localism Act of 2010, became law in May and requires satellite companies to provide HD channels for non-commercial stations in any markets where they carry other stations in HD. The amendment was penned by Representative Anna Eshoo of California, who expressed her outrage at DISH's move late last week, claiming that, quote, if DISH has room to carry pornography, they can find room for PBS. DISH claims that since HD channels utilize more bandwidth, the company should have the right to make the, quote, editorial decision whether to carry the channels.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, July 11, 2010, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today has been one of our more popular guests we've had over the years. She is the well-known author of numerous books, including Born to Buy, The Overworked American, and The Overspent American. She is a professor of sociology at Boston College. And Juliet Shore, our guest, is also the author of a brand new book that's getting a lot of attention, Plenitude. And she's here to talk about the book with us today. Juliet Shore, welcome to Media Matters.
Oh, thank you. Great pleasure to speak with you again, Bob.
Yeah, well, Juliet Shore, let's start with the title, Plenitude. What does that mean? Why did you name the book this? It's a word I don't think I hear very often, so why did you pick that as your title?
Well, the mainstream discourse on both the economy and the ecological environment is that people are going to have to do with less, that we have austerity coming down the line, whether it's the talk about deficit reduction and how Americans have to save more and are out-of-control consumers from the economic side, or on the environmental side, the mainstream argument for decades now has been, well, if you want to have a safe or a healthy environment, you're going to have to give something up. And this book is a challenge to that kind of trade-off and austerity mentality. And what it argues is that doing well by the planet actually is something that will also do well for people, so that people and the planet thrive together, and that when we invest in the planet and allow it to produce the plenitude that it's capable of, human beings will also be much better off.
And we're going to go through this throughout the program, but just so this doesn't seem too abstract to listeners just tuning in, what sort of economy does or world are we talking about? Just make a more concrete discussion of what that means, and then we'll back up and get up to it again in more detail later.
Well, at the beginning of my book, I make it clear that I'm mostly talking about people in the wealthy countries, the so-called developed countries, and primarily this book is about the United States. But I think there is also a way in which it's relevant for people everywhere, and I can be a little more concrete about that as we get into the specifics of the book. One of the reasons for that is that I think some of what I'm arguing is something that you can see being advocated in some of the most successful development programs in the Global South, and so it's partly a matter of paying attention to what development experts from the North have learned over the last few decades.
But I mean, in terms of what an economy would look like, is a plenitude economy? How is it different from the current economy, I guess, in tangible sense?
Okay, I guess I wasn't understanding your question. So there are a couple of dimensions to that. One is that it's an economy in which people devote less of their time and energy to what we can think of as the formal market, particularly large corporations. Over the last few decades, the average American has been spending many more hours at work, also having many more of his or her needs met by purchasing services and goods and services in the market. And so, one of the major things about the plenitude economy is that people reclaim some of their time and then use it to make and do things for themselves and to invest in their local community. So that's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
Less time spent earning money. Number two is scale. I mean, this is a vision of a transition to a much smaller scale economy. We've heard a lot in recent months since the financial meltdown about too big to fail as it pertains to financial institutions. But that same problem is also present in many other sectors of our economy, whether we're talking about energy, we have the debacle of BP going on now, automobiles, housing, agribusiness, chemicals, these giant corporations which have been really ravaging the planet. And, you know, since the 1970s, there's been a social debate saying, you know, clean up your act, and they haven't. In fact, they're still trying to prevent even, basic things like climate legislation. So this is an economy which says, let's disinvest from those large corporations. Smaller is better. Small scale is more beautiful. And so moving us to an economy in which many more people are business owners, in which there are many more cooperatives and small-scale units. And I would say those are two of the key differences from what we have today.
Our guest you've just been listening to is Juliet Shore, the author of the brand new book Plenitude, just released. Juliet Shore is a professor at Boston College, author of numerous other highly acclaimed books, The Overworked American, The Overspent American, and Born to Buy. She's been on our show many times before. If you'd like to call into Media Matters with a question or comment to talk about Plenitude with Juliet Shore, the phone number here is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And Juliet Shore, it seems to me as I was reading the book that, and I must say that the book is really, in its discussion of both the economy and the environment, how the two work together in economics, I've never seen anything that's been quite as strong and succinct and really brings so much great material together. So I'm going to congratulate you on that.
Thank you.
The question I have is that, you know, it strikes me that one of the pillars upon which you're making your argument is that the current state of capitalism in the United States, or what you call business as usual, there's not much of a future for it, almost independent of the environment. When you throw that log on the fire, then the whole thing blows up. But there's that capitalism going forward for the visible future. Stagnation looks to be the order of the day. Is that a fair assessment of your argument?
I think so, and particularly for the United States. I think there was just an article probably in the Times today or yesterday pointing out how much better many other countries have done than the U.S. in bouncing back from the meltdown that began at the end of 2007. What I argue at the beginning of the book is that if you think about particularly the corporate sector of the economy, it's on a trajectory in which I think there's going to be declining profitability over the next couple of decades, in which there will be relatively anemic job growth in the United States from that private sector. We are a declining economy in global terms, so an imperial power whose competitive position is falling relative to other countries who are rising. And then add on top of that the costs and stresses from a deteriorating planetary ecology and also from other, local and regional ecosystems. So the book starts with that prediction and says, participation in investment in that economy for the average person is going to yield a lot less than it has over the last couple of decades. So that is a fair assessment, and I think I just wrote a blog post on this 2 days ago that since the book has been written, and I wrote more than a year ago, I actually wrote that first chapter where I discussed this, events have, you know, very much borne me out, which is that there's been minimal progress on the jobs front and looking like there's not even a political impetus to do something about that. The recovery has been very anemic, and if you took away the stimulus, you know, would be even worse. And I think they're just, it's hard to see where a really robust economy will come from if we keep doing things the way we have been.
You know, just on that last point you made, which isn't in the book, but it's what you're blogging about, the, you know, we're roughly, what, 10% official unemployment now, rounded up or down a little bit. And as you said, it's striking that in the mainstream political discourse in both parties in Washington, except for an occasional rhetorical line, but in terms of real-world policies, what they're doing, this doesn't seem to be much of a concern. It seems to be that this level of unemployment is more or less acceptable now in the United States going forward.
Yes, and it is a little bit surprising how little discussion there is of doing something about this. But I think it's a combination of two things. I mean, one of them is if you look at the policies of the Bush administration, the second Bush administration over those 8 years, they pretty much systematically, did things to really undermine the domestic economy. They really didn't care less about it, and, you know, we see the consequences of that now. But there was virtually no opposition to that over all those years. So there's been a shift. We have now corporations who are very globally oriented, and they just basically said, you know, let these kind of disastrous policies go on. The second thing is that you can have a recovery of corporate profits, which we are seeing at least in some of these companies, in ways that have no benefit for the people of the country, both because you have that disconnect and also, you know, because of the global nature of these companies. So the sorts of things that we used to talk about back in the 1970s as we saw corporations going so much more global are really coming home to roost, which is that kind of disembedding of companies from this local context, from the national context, really. And since they're so dominant in politics, powerful multinationals have, you know, such a hold over Congress and the Washington discourse, I suppose we shouldn't be surprised that the unemployed are just being abandoned.
Our guest today, Juliet Shorey, you've just been listening to the professor from Boston College and author of the brand new book, which we're talking about in today's show, Plenitude. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Juliet Shorey, the number is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our phone lines right now. Line 4, Indiana, you're on the air with Juliet Shorey.
Hello. Two things. One, assuming that, wages are going to continue their downward spiral and things like that, normally this is offset by militaristic spending. So I wonder if you would talk about that, you know, in the sense of still retaining our power worldwide, but sort of sticking it to the local people. And secondly, I wonder if you could put this in historical context in any way whatsoever. I'm trying to remember stuff back from college, but I have a feeling that when the British Empire sort of folded, that the military outpost increased, and I don't know what the businessmen, what position they took, but if you knew anything about that or whether or not there's anything done at all, you know, to the Athenian Empire or anything, is there just sort of a constant, when these things happen, you turn to the military and let the people stuff go, and then things get interesting worldwide. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Juliet Shorey?
Yeah, those are great questions. Let me take the empire question first, the history.
Okay.
I think you do have empires that attempt to maintain their position through militarism, but there's only so long this works, and that's, you know, pretty much what we're seeing in the U.S. At the moment. And the other thing I would say about this is everything's speeded up now because the speed of economic change is so much faster than it was at the time the British Empire went into decline, or the Roman or any other empire. So, yes, military spending is part of how empires attempt to maintain position, but ultimately you can't maintain an imperial position only with that. If the underlying economy is really central for generating technological change and the things which you need to maintain your power, so you can get into a situation like we're in which we have to spend more and more of our national wealth maintaining a military whose purpose is to get other countries to take our dollars even when they don't want to, or to get oil, of course, that's absolutely key. So long run, this will fail. The other, I think, really strong parallel with the British situation is the increasing role of finance, because that's what happened in the British case. Their financial sector grew increasingly dominant, and their manufacturing sector went into long-term decline. It impoverished the country as a whole, so that you have the British working class becoming, one of the worst off in Europe, at the same time that you had the city generating, that's their Wall Street, generating enormous amounts of wealth, but which it, weren't shared out to the country, and we see that being repeated here in the United States. There is an effort to do something about our out-of-control military spending. My Congressman Barney Frank is involved in it, just put out a big report. It's a bipartisan effort with some strong Republican support. Ron Paul is very active in this, trying to show that we need to not just cut social spending and so forth with all this deficit talk, but military spending really needs to be addressed.
One of the things, Julia Sher, when I was reading your book, that struck me was that this wasn't a topic you got to, because it seems that military spending and militarism is such a large part of the American economy today. I don't know the exact figure of the federal spending, and I guess it varies depending on what you include in it, but it's anywhere from $700 billion to $1.1 trillion of federal money every year go to the military sector. And can you have a plenitude economy, a green economy with that large? Is there a way to, eco-friendly the Pentagon and the war effort? How does that fit into the picture?
Well, ultimately, you cannot have a sustainable economy with the kind of military that we have. It is the world's largest polluter, and just has an enormous ecological footprint. There are actually efforts within within the DOD to reduce their eco impact. I have friends who have been involved in that. I don't know how far they will get. I mean, they can, there can be something. I think, a key part of this is as we get off fossil fuels, the need for, quote, I'm putting that in quotations, need, or let's say the impetus for the huge U.S. military presence in all of the places where oil especially and natural gas to some extent is produced around the world will really decline. So, yes, it's certainly a key part of it. My book doesn't talk really much about federal policy and so forth. It's very much oriented to households and what they can do at sort of on a small scale, but certainly, when we start to talk about how the government needs to change, that's, very much at the top of the list.
Our guest, Juliet Shore, author of Plenitude. Let's go back to the phone lines again. Line 4, Spring Bay, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. Do you have any idea how much time we're talking about in terms of this transition period from where we are now to where we're going, at, you're talking about in your book, into a more localized economy.
Thank you, caller.
Yeah, thanks. That's an important question. In the book, I'm talking about a time frame of a couple of decades. Now, that's not to say that we have a couple of decades, say, on climate policy. We need to get climate legislation and start to really make inroads on what's happening with emissions of greenhouse gases, for example, right away. We really are in a critical window in the next couple of years on sort of making a U-turn in terms of emissions. But the time frame that I'm dealing with in the book is a more gradual one in which you have people progressively moving labor out of the corporate sector, starting to build up activities and initiatives at a more local and regional level, those entities growing, and then importantly, those entities becoming an important political force, which also then is able to transform what the federal government and also, you know, state governments are doing on issues of economics and ecology. I mean, this is part of the reason I ended up writing a book, sort of households and individuals leading a change, is the frustration that we've had at the federal level for so long in terms of getting meaningful legislation through, particularly on climate.
And as I read the book, Julie, sure, I mean, I think it's one of the key points of the book. It is that even if there were policies to bring back robust economic growth in the United States by conventional standards, GDP growth and income growth in the United States, to get us back to the 1990s or even better yet, probably to the 1950s or 60s when it didn't rely as much on debt, that the environment doesn't really permit us that option. Ecologically, that's not a course we can really pursue, even if it was possible. Is that a fair way to put it?
Absolutely. I think, you know, to me, one of the most important things that I argue in the book at the beginning is to say that the whole discourse of the mainstream economic discourse after the financial meltdown was, how do we get back to business as usual? How do we get people back to buying more cars and building more houses and, you know, buying more consumer goods, taking on more debt, and so forth? At the same time, if you look at what the scientists have been telling us in terms of what is happening to the planet on climate primarily, but not only, on biodiversity, on the growth of dead zones in oceans, on desertification, on droughts and flooding, and, you know, a whole range of things, that business as usual economy is a disaster. It is destroying the very life support systems on which we depend. And so what I say in the book is that scientists are, you know, predicting catastrophe, and the economists are basically talking about how we can get there faster. and so it's just crazy, the disconnect between these two discourses, between the economic discourse and the environmental or the ecological discourse. And so, you know, a big part of my book is to try and put those things together and say, okay, well, what do we need to do to get back to the things that we need from an economy, like livelihoods and full employment, however we define it, innovation, entrepreneurialism, and so forth, and at the same time do that in a way that not just stops degrading the planet but actually begins to restore it. Because one of the things that, you know, the thing that we haven't faced up to yet is how much we have run down the ecosystems of the planet and how much work we have to do in terms of investing in restoring them.
You know, one of the points you make in the book, and I want to emphasize to readers that in Plenitude, Juliet Shore does in two or three chapters as fine a job of laying out sort of the environmental consequences of doing nothing, what it means for all of us, as I've seen in a popular book. But, you know, one of the things that you do also, as you point out in the failure of conventional economics to deal with the environment and ecological issues, is just how the actual ecological cost of doing capitalism, of doing business, just aren't even factoring in its cost. And I think a lot of people aren't really aware of that, and how if you were to factor in the cost of cleaning up the environment into the production and consumption, it would really change our understanding of the current economy dramatically.
Absolutely. I mean, people have probably heard this because it's the most obvious current example, but it may be that the incredible disaster unfolding in the Gulf, the oil travesty of BP, will end up increasing our GNP because we're only going to be counting the costs of the spill, and we have no accounting for what has been destroyed. So it's an accounting system which only takes one side of the ledger. If we pollute the air a lot and cause people to have asthma and cancer and so forth, the cost of their health care will go into the GNP and raise it, but there won't be any commensurate reduction for the destruction of clean air or the destruction of health. So it's a crazy system. It was instituted, you know, back at the early part of the 20th century when people were not thinking about these things at all. And it's not just that we have this kind of accounting, you know, because of inertia or because we're too stupid to figure out how to do it right. It's because powerful political interests have blocked the a real accounting. In the early 1990s, the Bureau of Economic Analysis started to do real environmental accounting so that we could figure out what was happening to ecosystems and try and incorporate that into our economic statistics. And the coal lobby forced a bill through Congress making it illegal for the BEA to do that. And it was only very recently that prohibition has been lifted, and you know, hopefully at some point we'll get some decent statistics, but we're still, you know, far away from the right kind of calculations. I mean, one thing that this does is it makes a lot of things seem profitable and efficient, which really aren't, and it also makes the clean, green ways of doing things and products much more costly than they really are, more costly in money terms than they really are.
Our guest, Juliet Shore. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. Juliet Shore is professor at Boston College, author of numerous books, including the brand new book, Plenitude, which we're discussing today. If you'd like to call in, the number here at WILL is 333-9455, or our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And Juliet Shore is one who's read all your other books, and we've had you on to talk about Born to Buy, I think twice. It was such a, in my view, profound book. I wasn't surprised to see your discussion in the book, but I think it will be something of great interest to people because I don't think it's largely appreciated, of the fast fashion movement and this whole sort of manic, out-of-control hyper-capitalism of the past two decades where we've seen this sort of speeding up of purchasing of consumer durables, products that once, you know, you bought and you kept for as long as you could and you replaced them, they were broken, to where we also have a throwaway society for durable products that, you know, to hear you write about it strikes us as being really insane.
Yeah. In the second chapter of my book, I present data that I collected on the weight and units of what Americans were consuming. Now, this, you know, seems pretty obvious that this would be something economists would be looking at, but it turns out that economists only look at dollar values for the most part. Again, another, you know, failure of our statistics. So we don't actually even know the weights or the numbers of units of the things that we produce. And I had to calculate them mostly from import data, which is not a perfect source because we don't have the data from the domestic. But since so much more of what we are consuming is being imported in terms of these consumer goods, I thought it was a good place to start. And what I found was that over the 90s and into the 2000s, the speed of what I call this, you know, the cycle of acquiring and discarding products sped up very dramatically. And I started with apparel because that was the place where I was seeing it first. The average American purchased about 34 pieces of apparel, outerwear, underwear, not including hosiery, in 1991. By 2007, I think was the last year I had, the average person was purchasing about 69 pieces of apparel, so more than twice as many pieces of clothing. And I also collected data on the discard of clothing and show that it moves right along with the import of new clothing, no surprise. So the country imports new clothing. The more and more we do that, the more people throw out, send abroad, donate, et cetera, the clothes that they don't want. And I called it the fast fashion model, the sort of speed up of that cycle in terms of how long people are holding consumer goods. And then I looked at it in furniture, which has had an astronomical increase, and glassware, ceramics, consumer electronics, of course, sporting goods, I mean, musical instruments, jewelry, pretty much everything that consumers are buying, we've had a big speed up in that. I mean, furniture is one of the really ecologically important and, you know, most telling cases where people are now buying and discarding furniture in such a short window. That was one of those kinds of goods that you mentioned, that not only might it people have the same furniture for a generation, they might also inherit from previous generations.
Our guest, Juliet Shore. I'm Bob McChesney. Let's go back to the phone lines right now to line one. Champagne, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I've heard only part of your program. I've heard a great deal that I agree with, but I would just like to say I've been thinking for years. There was a book published in the 70s entitled The Limits to Growth, which has been criticized a great deal for various reasons. I recently went to the website of a supposedly liberal economist, Paul Krugman, and he was talking about how it was essentially referring to the whole idea that there are limits to growth, that growth, economic growth, shouldn't just go on forever. This was something that he just couldn't digest somehow, and the guest was talking about the complete disconnect between what economists think and it's hardly even what scientists think. It's the obvious fact that there are limited resources on the earth. They are being used. Using them creates waste of all kinds. The waste is getting worse. The commercial culture of buying is horrendous. My wife is horrified. We have children in high school, and if there's any kind of a club, if there's any kind of an event, if there's any kind of an anything, there has to be a T-shirt for it. And the T-shirt is often free. This idea, things aren't worth anything, whether they're plastic bags or food or clothing. They're almost worthless. And on the one hand, one buys. On the other hand, one throws away. And the culture, no one in the political system understands that this has to end somehow. And the question is it going to end horribly, or is it going to end somewhat less horribly? And no one seems to get it. And I will now hang up and turn up my radio. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And I think that's actually probably the perfect question for you, Juliet Shore, because that's the framing that very sensitive, smart, educated, thoughtful people living this world, it's not an uncommon way to pose the question. But your book is saying, actually, it's not quite like that. Isn't that right?
Well, 2 points, I think. One is my book does deal with the limits to growth debate and what economists thought and why they were wrong about it. And so I think, you know, the reader may be interested in that, which is in my chapter 2,
mm-hmm.
And also in chapter 3 to a certain extent. The sort of crux of it is that the economists believe that we will be able to dematerialize each dollar of output, because they're talking about growth in money terms. I mean, so growth of GDP, for example, that we can so dematerialize it that the impacts on the planet will be negligible. And the evidence on that so far is very much against the economists. We have had some amount of that dematerialization, but by no means is it happening at the rate at which it would need to in order to avoid ecological catastrophe. So that the economists, you know, what they argued was true in theory, but has been absolutely really very, very difficult to achieve in practice. And so now, 3 decades later, I think we can safely say that they were wrong about that, despite having arguments that went along with their models pretty well. It was a kind of magical thinking on their part that you could just somehow make economic activity not have a material basis. This, by the way, is exactly why I started looking at the material volumes of goods, because that is what's relevant from an ecological point of view. On the question of how it all ends, my book is an attempt to give us a, you know, to use a term that's in vogue now, a soft landing. So it's a way forward that would allow us to kind of gradually reduce footprint in a way that maintains well-being for people. So I think we can do it, but the problem is that we have economic interests which are so powerful that they are preventing the kind of change that we need. And so, you know, we have very much a political problem rather than an economic problem.
You know, I'd like to talk about that in a second, because you mentioned earlier that, you know, you didn't go into the politics much. You were dealing more with how households and individuals could sort of understand and deal with the problem. But before we go to that, I mean, I think you're being a little modest about what you're demonstrating in the book, Juliet Shore, because, you know, I think unless I misunderstood what you wrote, you're saying that there are actually now technologies and an understanding of how to organize production environmentally sound manner that permit us to actually, well, by conventional standards, it might seem like you're consuming fewer T-shirts or fewer buckets of oil. But in terms of actual quality of life, there's no reason we can't actually have far superior lives by our conventional understanding and our social science understanding of what makes people happy.
That is absolutely true. You did not misunderstand me.
No, and I think so. I think you're being modest in the sense that, you know, we have a soft landing. I think you're actually saying that if we play our cards right, we can rise.
Yes, that's true. I mean, in part was responding to the caller who I think is right to say, and, you know, this I do say it in my book, if we keep on as we have been, it's going to be pretty horrendous. So if we sort of did everything that I propose in the book, if we really took this plenitude path, people will be much better off, because in addition to having their needs met in terms of food and shelter and clothing and also rich consumer lives, something I talk about in the book. This is by no means an anti-consumer kind of orientation. But in addition to all those things, the path that I'm talking about gives us free time, allows the average person to have much more creativity, to have more social capital, connection with others, and I think more control over their lives. I mean, one of the things about the corporate capitalism that we have today is that people may be getting a lot of stuff, but they don't have a lot of control over their lives. And that undermines their well-being pretty dramatically. It's also a very stressful lifestyle for many, many people. And the lifestyle that I'm talking about in this book should be much less so. It should give people more security, more safety, and more rootedness, all of which will enhance their well-being, and that's something we know now from a lot more research on what creates well-being than we had.
Yeah, and, you know, I do want to get back to the phone lines. We have a couple of callers waiting patiently to speak with you, Juliet Shore, but I do want you, just on that point, it's so important. It's been in you've gotten to this a little bit in Born to Buy and some of your earlier work, but I think you really bring it all together in Plenitude, which is, you know, really looking at what makes people happy, what the research shows, and what our, you know, how effectively what our economy does links up to making people happy, or more accurately at times unhappy.
Right. I mean, we have an economy in which basically what people get locked into is what I've called the work and spend cycle. So they're working long hours, they're getting incomes and spending those incomes. The thing is that the increasing incomes – don't yield nearly as much well-being as people expect them to. And over time, you know, maybe not very much at all. That's now we have lots of research on that. The things that do give people well-being are strong social relationships, good marriages or long-term relationships, physical health, which is undermined by long hours and debt and that kind of hyper-consuming lifestyle, as you called it. And meaning and purpose are really key. And a lot of people have ended up trading off meaning and purpose in their lives for a good paycheck, you know, for understandable reasons. But they definitely suffer from it. And then the last thing, and there's now a really fascinating literature on this, which I talk a little bit about in the book, is connection to nature, and that the more disconnected we are from nature, the less well-being we have, everything else being equal. It turns out that human beings do much better when they are in closer contact with the natural world. And to destroy the natural world in order to get more stuff, which isn't really giving us all that much well-being, you know, is pretty much a system failure.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest again is Juliet Shore, author of the new book, Plenitude. Juliet Shore is a professor at Boston College, author of numerous books before this, including Born to Buy. If you'd like to join us, we probably have time for a couple more calls after the ones in the lines now. The number here at Will is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Now let's go to line two, Champagne. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air.
Yes, I just want to say that I disagree very strongly with your guest. It's the same argument that Malthus used and Ehrlich used and Sagan used, and they've all been proven wrong. The only system that provides great innovation, progress, growth, human happiness is the free market entrepreneurial capitalistic system. Your guest talks about happiness. Happiness is individual. What makes one person happy may not make another person happy. It's only through freedom and the free market entrepreneurial capitalistic system that we have this ability to be free. In the world right now, the air is cleaner than it's ever been. People are living longer than they've ever been. The earth is cleaner than it's ever been. And all these, I guess you'd call it measurements of progress, have all been caused by the free market entrepreneurial system. So here again, your author, it's a tired argument that's been proven wrong time and time again. And it's the individual freedom that will enhance our future, not the kind of collective talk that this type of writing covers.
Okay, well, thank you very much, caller. Juliet Shore, I like that you respond specifically the argument at the end that the sort of collectivism versus individualism notion that the caller had.
Yeah, well, I want to thank the caller for his comment. And I'm going to urge him to read the book because I think he's reading some things into what I'm saying that aren't there. But let me just get to some of the specifics of it. First of all, the idea that Malthus, Ehrlich, et cetera, are wrong, I think is not borne out by looking at the data. We have more hungry people today than we have ever had in the history of humanity. Now, so there are a billion people today hungry on the planet, despite the incredible increases in agricultural productivity. But one of the things about those Green Revolution and so forth that we're seeing now is that we had a few decades of high yields, which have led to unsustainability in those ecosystems. So we've got water shortages, we have soil erosion, we have incredible contamination of the soil through those pesticides and herbicides. And the caller is just not right about the state of the earth. There's now voluminous literature on this. And again, you can look in my book or you can look at pretty much anywhere. The idea that the air is cleaner now, in the United States we have had improvements in local air quality, but if you look at what's going on in the atmospheric system in terms of pollutants in the air, carbon dioxide being the most important, but not only, we have world historic high rates of concentration, which have destabilized our climate system and which are leading us to, you know, possibly catastrophic impacts. happiness, yes, you can say it's individual, but in fact, there's lots and lots of research to show that there are certain factors which lead to more happiness. I mean, the caller's own comments suggest the one factor that he believes leads to happiness, which is freedom. And he may or may not be right about that. But to end on the point about collectivism, my book is about a way for individuals to make changes in their lives that will make them better off and, in fact, as I said earlier, give them more freedom. The idealized free market that he's talking about no longer exists. Our markets are dominated by large corporate entities and governments that are operating them in ways that are undermining the well-being of people, and that's probably a point the caller and I would agree on, and it's also why a lot of conservatives have liked my arguments in my book. So I'm encouraging him to take a look at it and email me back after he has and see how much disagreement we really have.
Our guest, Juliet Shore. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're discussing her brand new book, Plenitude. Let's go back to the phone lines for another patient caller. Line 3, Springfield. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you, Bob, for taking my call. I just quickly wanted to interject a question for your guest concerning cap and trade, because it seems to be a very popular topic, especially among the political class, and what you might say about it, because it seems on the face like a really good PR statement about what it means for corporations to be accountable to what they do to the environment, but it still seems like more or less a neoclassical economic band-aid to be applied to this, in that you're ultimately still handing the corporations the rights, the explicit rights to pollute the environment. I didn't know if she had a stance on that, so that was my question, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Juliet Shore?
Yeah, great question. The devil's in the details, because you could put in a cap-and-trade system that's very strict and gives us the kinds of reductions in emissions that we need. And also in the limit, a cap-and-trade system is similar to a tax in some ways. It depends on where you set the caps, how high you set the taxes and so forth. Those are the two major policy options that we've been talking about in this country. In Britain, they went for a cap and trade in large part because the financial sector saw it as a way to make a lot of money by creating new markets and these assets that they could then trade, buy and sell. And that's a big part, I think, right now of the skepticism for cap and trade in this country after the financial meltdown, because it's another fancy market that Wall Street is going to get rich on. So that's the negative part of it. At this point, what's really essential is that we get legislation that does something about the volume of emissions, the volume of pollution that is generated by our economy. And I think in many ways a tax would be simpler in the U.S. just because we have such a history of corporate ability to take laws and or institutional structures and kind of meddle with them in ways that undermine their true aims.
Let's go to our final caller for the day now. Line 1, Dewey, Illinois. You're on the air with Juliet Shore.
Yes, I wonder to what degree population growth impacts the damage to the planet. It would be a simplistic view, I guess, but one that on the face of it would have some weight.
Thank you very much, caller. Juliet Shore?
Yeah, of course, back in the 60s, Ehrlich, and I think also the limits to growth, people saw population as really key. As it turns out, the biggest ecological impacts have come in countries where population growth is declining or maybe fairly small. In the U.S., we have a lot of our population's growth is from immigration, not all of it. It turns out that growing incomes have been a lot more important to ecological degradation, particularly if we're talking about the large-scale problems. So I talk in the book about population. I think it is much less the issue that we have to deal with than rising incomes. And if you look at the ecological impact of another person born in India or China in comparison to a person born in a high-income country, we're talking about magnitudes of, 20, 30 times differences. So I think the real key is to get the wealthy of the world to get their impact down. Going forward, the growth of middle classes, really big middle classes in places like India and China, of course, turns out to be ecologically quite significant and something that we really have to worry about. But that, again, that's growing incomes rather than just numbers of people.
Julia Shore, we've only got a few minutes left, and you don't in the book go through the huge political fights which you acknowledge are necessary to actually make possible plenitude in any sort of dominant or meaningful sense. But one thing you do in the book we haven't had a chance to talk about yet that I found really enlightening was you discussed how technologies developed such that really small local production units are much more economically efficient than the traditional large super factory. The system that had justified the massive corporation and the semi-monopoly, there's no longer any economic justification for it, you argue. They just really hang on by their political power.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the impact of the information revolution. That's what computerization and all these new technologies have done, which is that they've now changed the nature of economies of scale and what is they've made possible a high-efficiency, small-scale economy. And that's really, really important going forward. Because it means that we no longer need a global production system, for example, and the ecological impacts of which are quite disastrous, and also that individuals can have much more control over their own lives, because you can exist in small firms, cooperatives, self-employment, and so on and so forth, in ways that actually are not as they were 50 or 75 years ago, where you don't have to pay a big economic penalty to get smallness. In the book, I anticipate that going forward, you're going to have a shrinkage in size of firm, and that's going to have a lot of good political benefits as well as benefits to the individuals who are in that firm. And we're already seeing over the last couple of decades that it's the small firms where you're getting innovation and also employment growth. The big firms are dinosaurs, and I think the sooner we kind of recognize that and begin a shift to a different kind of economy, the much better off we're all going to be.
Our guest today has been Juliet Shore, who's joined us today to talk about her new book, Plenitude. Juliet Shore, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Oh, you have great callers, as always.
Yeah, I know. It makes my job really easy. I could just drink lemonade here and listen to them do all my work for me. I hear the band tuning up. They got to clear us out of here. And good luck with your book, and I'm looking forward to have you back in the air at some point in the future.
Thanks. Look forward to it, too. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. I also want to thank Kyle Kroha for working the board today, our engineer, Melissa Trentz, my wonderful producer, has done a great job organizing the show. I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580, and I will be back with you all, beloved listeners, in 167 hours. Have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny today, and there's a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms late in the afternoon with a high of 88 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy and a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms, a low of 62. Showers and thunderstorms are likely Monday morning with a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon, the high 85. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana.